He's up to six. He's looking for victim number seven, I said. Far below, on an inaccessible beach, we could see sea lions, brown pelicans, cormorants. I wish that Damon and Janny were here to see them, and I wish the circumstances of my being here were completely different. Out on the terrace, I took Kate's hand. "Makes us look like we belong," I said, and winked at her. "Maybe we do." Kate gave an exaggerated wink back. We watched Rudolph approach a striking blonde woman. She was the gentleman's type, in her early 20s, shapely, beautiful face. She was also Casanova's type, I couldn't help thinking. Her wavy, sun-bleached hair fell to her tiny waist. She wore a red and yellow flowered dress from Putumayo's that flowed down to a pair of black European work boots. She flowed when she moved as well. She was drinking champagne by the glass. I hadn't spotted Agents Cosgrove or Asaro yet, which was making me a little nervous, a little nuts.
"She's beautiful, isn't she? She's just perfect," Kate whispered at my side. "We can't let him hurt her, Alex. We can't let anything happen to that poor woman."
"We won't," I said. "But we have to catch him in the act, nail him for kidnapping, if nothing else. We need evidence that he is the gentleman caller." I finally spotted John Asaro at the crowded main bar. He had on a bright yellow Nike T-shirt and fit in okay. I didn't spot Ray Cosgrove, or any of the other agents, which was actually a good sign. Rudolph and the young blonde woman seemed to have hit it off immediately. She appeared to be gregarious and fun-loving. She had perfect white teeth, and her smile was dazzling. She couldn't help but make an impression across the crowded room. My brain was sliding into overload. We were watching the gentleman caller at work, weren't we?
"He's hunting, and just like that," Kate snapped her fingers, "he picks them up. Gets almost any woman he wants. That's how he does it. So simple."
"It's the way he looks that gets them, Alex," Kate continued. "He has a rebellious look about him, and he's very handsome. That combination is irresistible to some women." She let him think it was his line of small talk that won her over, but it's because he's such a hunk.
"So she just picked him up?" I asked. "Our killer hunk?" Kate nodded. She wouldn't take her eyes off the two of them.
"She just picked up the gentleman caller. He wanted her to, of course. I bet that's how he gets them, and why he never gets caught."
"It's not how Casanova works, though, is it?"
"Maybe Casanova isn't good-looking."
Kate turned and looked at me.
"That might explain the masks he wears. Maybe he's ugly or disfigured, and ashamed of how he looks."
I had another thought, another theory about Casanova and his masks, but I didn't want to say anything just yet. The gentleman and his new girlfriend ordered ambrosia burgers, the house specialty. So did Kate and I. When in paradise. They hung around the cafe until around 7 o'clock and then got up to leave. Kate and I rose from our table, too. Actually, I was half enjoying myself, considering the eerie circumstances. We had a table that overlooked the water. Down below, the Pacific crashed against a black wall of slippery rocks, and we could hear sea lions barking loudly. I noted that there was no touching between the two of them as they walked out to the parking lot. It suggested to me that one of them was secretly shy. Dr. Will Rudolph politely held open the door of his Range Rover, and the blonde woman was laughing as she hopped in. He performed a tiny, elegant bow at the car door. The gentleman. She chose him, I was thinking. It wasn't kidnapping yet. She was still making choices for herself. We had nothing to go after him for, nothing to hold him on. Perfect crimes. On both coasts. Chapter 69. We trailed the Range Rover at a discreet distance, straight back to the cabin. I parked about a quarter of a mile up the road. My heart was hammering hard and loud. This was the moment of truth. The real deal was going down now. Kate and I ran back through the woods and found a safe spot that was well hidden from view. It was less than 50 yards from Dr. Rudolph's hideaway, and we could still hear the musical tinkle of the wind chimes as they moved gently. The cold, damp sea mist was inching in, and I could feel a chill right up through my shoes. The gentleman caller was inside that cabin up ahead, getting ready to do what? My stomach felt hollow and incredibly tight.
I wanted to move on him in the worst way. I didn't want to think about how many times Dr. Will Rudolph had done this before, taken a young woman somewhere, mutilated her, taken home feet, eyes, fingers, a human heart, souvenirs of his kill. I glanced at my wristwatch. Rudolph had been inside the cabin for only a few minutes with the blonde woman from Nepenthe. I'd seen movement in the woods on the other side of the house. The FBI was there. It was getting hairy.
"Alex, what if he kills her?" Kate asked.
She stood close to me, and I could feel the heat from her body. She knew what it felt like to be a captive in a house of horror. She understood the danger better than anyone. He doesn't grab his victims and kill them immediately. "The gentleman caller has his routine," I said to Kate. "He's kept every one of his victims for a day. He likes to play. He won't break away from the pattern." I believed that, but I didn't know it for certain. Maybe Dr. Rudolph knew we were outside. Maybe he wanted to get caught. Maybe, maybe, maybe. I remembered stalking the madman Garisona G. Murphy. It was hard not to rush the cabin. Take our chances right now. We might find physical evidence of other murders inside. Maybe the missing body parts were kept here. Maybe he did the actual killing here in Big Sur. Or maybe he was planning another kind of surprise for us. The drama was unfolding less than 50 yards away. "I'm going to try to get in a little closer," I finally said to Kate. "I have to see what's happening in there."
"I'm glad you said that," Kate whispered.
The talk was cut short. A blood-curdling scream came from the cabin.
"Help! Help me! Somebody help me!"
the blonde woman screamed. I ran at full speed for the closest door into the cabin. So did at least 5 men in dark blue windbreakers from the other side of the house. I spotted Asaro and Cosgrove among them. FBI, the windbreakers read. Rainslicker yellow on navy blue. All hell was breaking loose in Big Sur. We were about to meet the gentleman. Chapter 70. I got there first, at least I think I did. I threw myself hard against the cabin's wood-plank back door. It wouldn't give. On the second try, the frame splintered and the door burst open with a wounded grunt. I charged into the cabin with my pistol drawn. I could see across the small kitchen and all the way down a narrow hallway that led into a bedroom. The blonde woman from Nepenthe was naked and curled sideways on an antique brass bed. Wildflowers had been thrown around her body. Her wrists were pinioned with handcuffs near the small of her back. She was in pain, but at least she was still alive. The gentleman caller wasn't there. From outside the cabin, I heard a loud bark, the harsh sound of gunfire. At least 6 shots were fired in rapid succession, like a string of powerful firecrackers. "Jesus, don't kill him!" I shouted as I ran from the cabin. Complete chaos reigned in the woods. The Range Rover was already backing wildly from the driveway when I came out. 2 of the FBI men were down on the ground. One was Agent Ray Cosgrove. The others had opened fire on the Range Rover. A side window exploded. Jagged holes opened in the Range Rover's sheet metal. The off-road vehicle swerved sideways, its wheels spinning in the dirt and gravel. "Don't kill him!" I yelled again. No one even looked at me in the wild confusion of the moment. I sprinted through the side woods, hoping to cut off Rudolph if he headed west, back toward Highway 1. I got there just as the Range Rover made a shrieking, skidding turn out onto the road. A gunshot blew out another side window. Great! The FBI was shooting at both of us now. I grabbed the passenger side door and yanked hard at the handle. It was locked. Rudolph tried to accelerate, but I held on tightly. The Rover fishtailed, still caught in a swale of driveway gravel. That gave me time to grab the roof rack with my free hand. I pulled myself onto the roof. Rudolph finally got the Rover onto the concrete roadway and accelerated. He floored the vehicle for 70 yards. Then he hit the brakes hard. I was thinking ahead, that far ahead, anyway. My face was pressed tightly against the sheet metal, which was still warm from sitting in the sun at Nepenthe. My arms and legs were splayed out against the roof rack. I was wedged like a Samsonite all-nighter on the roof. I wasn't coming off there, not if I could help it. He had killed at least 6 women around Los Angeles, and I had to find out if Naomi was still alive. He knew Casanova, and he knew about Scoochie. Rudolph floored the Range Rover again, and the engine roared through its gears as he tried to shake me loose. He was weaving all over the road. Trees and ancient telephone poles zoomed past me in blurry, fast motion. The rushing pines, redwoods, and mountain vines were like the changing patterns in a kaleidoscope. A lot of the foliage was brownish-gray, prickly as vineyards in the Napa Valley. It was a strange perspective on the world. I wasn't exactly enjoying the scenery from my perch on the Range Rover. It took all of my strength to concentrate on hugging the roof. Rudolph drove very fast along the winding narrow road, doing 70 or 80, where 50 was dangerous. The FBI agents, what was left of them, hadn't been able to catch up. How could they? They'd had to run back to their cars. They would be several minutes behind us. Other cars passed us as we got closer to the Pacific Coast Highway. Drivers gave us the strangest looks. I wondered what Rudolph was thinking as he drove. He wasn't trying to throw me off anymore. What options did he still have? In particular, what was he planning as his next move? We were both temporarily in check. Somebody had to lose, very big and very soon, though. Will Rudolph had always been too clever to be caught. He wouldn't expect to be stopped now. But how would he get out of this one? I heard the noisy diesel chug of a VW van. I saw the rear end of the van coming fast. We passed it as if it were standing still. There was a flow of traffic against us as we approached the ocean road, mostly kids out for an early evening spin. Some of them pointed at the Range Rover and thought it was a big joke. Just some major asshole from the Sur pulling a stunt, right? Some aging merry prankster high on tequila or maybe even 20-year-old acid. A crazed man hanging onto the roof of a Range Rover doing 70 miles an hour in what amounted to a very scenic parking lot. What was his next goddamn move? Rudolph didn't bother to slow down on the curvy, extremely populated blacktop road. The motorists, headed in the opposite direction, blared their horns angrily. No one did anything to stop us. What could they do? What could I do now? Hang on as tightly as I could and pray. Chapter 71. A bright flash of grayish-blue ocean broke through the scrim of fir and redwood branches. I heard rock music blasting from the slow-moving parade of cars up ahead. A collage of music was in the air. Pop 40 rap, West Coast grunge bands, acid rock from 30 years ago. Another splash of Pacific blue hit me right in the eye. The setting sun was casting its golden glow on the spreading firs. Wheeling terns and gulls passed slowly over the trees. Then I saw the full expanse of the Pacific Coast Highway up ahead. What the hell was he doing? He couldn't drive back to Los Angeles like this. Or was he crazy enough to try? Eventually, he'd have to stop for gas. What would he do then? Traffic on the highway was light heading north, but heavy moving south. The Range Rover was still doing 60 or better, careening faster than anyone ought to drive on the curvy side highway, especially as it merged into the busier coast road. Rudolph didn't slow down as he approached the crowded highway. I could see family station wagons, convertibles, four-wheel drive vehicles. Just another crazy Saturday night on the Northern California shoreline, but it was about to get a whole lot crazier. We were 50 yards from the highway now. He was going as fast as ever, if not faster. My arms were stiff and numb. My throat was dry from exhaust fumes. I didn't know how much longer I could hold on. Then suddenly I thought I knew what he was going to do. "You son of a bitch!" I yelled, just to yell. I wedged my body even tighter against the straining metal roof rails. Rudolph had created an impromptu escape plan. He was only 10 to 15 yards from the highway traffic, no more than that. Just as the Rover reached the sharp turn onto the Pacific Coast Highway, he braked hard. The loud screech of radial tires was terrifying, especially from where I was listening. A bearded face in a passing multicolored minivan yelled out, "Slow down, you asshole!" Which asshole, I wondered. This asshole definitely wanted to slow down. The top-heavy Range Rover held its path for a few yards, then it started to fishtail right, then left, then right again. It was total bedlam now. Horns were blowing everywhere at once on the busy highway. Drivers and passengers couldn't believe what they were seeing, what was bearing down on them from the side road. Rudolph was doing everything wrong at the wheel on purpose. He wanted the Rover to spin out. Its tires still squealing like animals being slaughtered, the Range Rover slid left until it was facing south, but it was actually traveling west into traffic. Then the Rover's tail end swerved all the way around. We were going to hit the traffic moving backward. We were going to crash. I was sure we would both be killed. Images of Damon and Janny flashed before me. I couldn't guess how fast we were going when we broadsided a silver-blue minivan. I didn't even try to hang on to the roof rack. I concentrated on relaxing my body, preparing for a bone-breaking, possibly deadly impact in the next few seconds. I yelled, but the sound of my voice was lost in the high-pitched screeching crash, the blaring car horns, the screaming spectators. I barely missed the lineup of northbound traffic as I jetted off the roof. More horns blared. I was flying through the air with the greatest of ease. The sea wind both cooled and stung my face. It was going to be a crash landing. I flew into the smoky blue mist that was settling between the Pacific Ocean and the Pacific Coast Highway. I hit the thick branches of a fir tree. As I fell through scraping, scratching tree branches, I knew the gentleman caller was going to escape.
Chapter 72. Skip forward, cut forward, spin, fall head over heels, forward.
I was badly shaken and bruised from the car crash and fall, but apparently there were no broken bones. A crackerjack EMS team looked me over at the accident site on Highway 1. They wanted to check me into a nearby hospital for tests and observation, but I had other plans for the night. The gentleman was running loose. He had commandeered a car heading north. The car had already been found, but not Dr. Rudolph, at least not so far. When she arrived at the bad scene at the highway, Kate went ballistic. She wanted me to go to the local hospital, too. Agent Cosgrove of the FBI was already there as a patient. We had a heated discussion, but eventually Kate and I caught the last Air West shuttle out of Monterey. We were headed back to L.A. I had spoken to Kyle Craig twice already. FBI teams were camped out at Rudolph's apartment in Los Angeles, but nobody expected the gentleman to return there. They were searching the place now. I wanted to be there with them. I needed to see exactly how he lived. On the flight, Kate continued to show concern about my physical condition. She had already developed a top-notch bedside manner, warm and empathetic, but also surprisingly firm with a stubborn patient like myself. Kate talked to me with her hand cupped lightly under my chin. She was intense. "Alex, you have to go to a hospital as soon as we get to Los Angeles. I'm serious. As you might be able to tell, this isn't my usual humor-in-the-face-of-adversity approach. You're going to a hospital as soon as we land. Hey, are you even listening to me?"
"I'm listening to you, Kate. I also happen to agree with what you're saying. Basically, that is."
"Alex, that's no answer. That's crap."
I knew Kate was right, but we didn't have time for a hospital check-in tonight. Dr. Will Rudolph's trail was still warm, and maybe we could pick up his scent and nab him in the next few hours. It was a slim chance, but by tomorrow the gentleman's trail could be stone cold.
"You could be bleeding internally, and you wouldn't even know it," Kate continued to make her case. "You could die right here in this airplane seat."
"I've got some nasty body bruises and contusions, and I ache all over. I've got the makings of some first-class scabs up and down my right side, where I made my first couple of bounces. I've got to see his apartment before they take it apart, Kate. I have to see how that bastard lives."
"Half a million or more a year? Trust me, he lives very well," Kate came back at me. "You, on the other hand, could be in bad shape. Human beings don't bounce."
"Ah, well, black human beings do. We've had to learn that special knack for survival. We hit the ground, we bounce right back."
Kate didn't laugh at my joke. She folded her arms across her chest and peered out the tiny plane's window. She was angry with me for the second time in hours. That must mean she cared. She knew she was right, and she wasn't backing down. I liked the fact that she was concerned for me. We were actually friends. What a fantastic concept for men and women in the 90s. Kate McTiernan and I had become friends during both our times of need. We were in the process of compiling that all-important dossier of shared experiences now. It was some kind of dossier so far.
"I like it that we're pals," I finally told Kate in a low, conspiratorial voice. I wasn't afraid to say cute, dumb things to her, almost the way I talked to my kids.
She didn't turn away from the window as she spoke, still pissed off at me. Good for her. I probably deserved it.
"If you were really my damn friend, you'd listen to me when I'm worried sick and frightened for you. You were in an automobile accident a few hours ago. You fell about 30 yards down a pretty steep ravine, pal."
"I hit a tree first."
She finally turned back to me and pointed a finger at my heart like a stake.
Big deal. Alex, I'm worried about your stubborn black ass. I'm worried so much my stomach hurts.
That's the nicest thing anybody said to me in months, I told her. Once when I was shot, Samson showed some genuine concern. It lasted about a minute and a half. Her brown eyes held onto mine and wouldn't let go, wouldn't lighten up.
I let you help me in North Carolina. I let you hypnotize me, for God's sake. Why won't you let me help you here? Let me help, Alex.
I'm working up to it, I told her. That was true enough.
Macho policemen have a tough field to hoe. We abhor being helped. We're classic enablers. Most of the time, we like it like that, too.
Oh, cut the psychobabble, doctor. It's self-serving and doesn't reflect you at your best.
I'm not at my best. I was just in a terrible accident.
It went on like that between us for the remainder of the shuttle flight to Los Angeles. Toward the end of the ride, I catnapped peacefully on Kate's shoulder. No complications, no unnecessary baggage. Very, very nice.
Chapter 73. Unfortunately, the California night was still young and probably extremely dangerous for everyone involved. When we arrived at Rudolph's penthouse apartment at the Beverly Comstock, the LAPD was everywhere. So was the Federal Bureau of Investigation. It was police bedlam. We could see the flashing crimson and blue emergency lights from several blocks away. The local police were justifiably angry for being kept out of the chase by the FBI. It was a very nasty, very political, very sensitive mess. This wasn't the first time the FBI had been high-handed with a local police agency. It had happened to me back in Washington. Plenty of times. The Los Angeles press posse was there, too, and in full force. Newspaper, local TV, radio, even a few film producers were on the scene. I wasn't happy that many of the reporters knew Kate and me by sight. They called out to us as we hurried through police lines and barricades. "Kate, give us a few minutes. Give us a break. Dr. Cross, is Rudolph the gentleman caller? What went wrong up in Big Sur? Is this the killer's apartment?"
"No comment right now," I said, trying to keep my head down, eyes down.
"From either one of us," Kate added.
The police and FBI led us inside the gentleman caller's apartment. Technical people were busy in every room of the expensive-looking penthouse. Somehow, the Los Angeles detectives seemed smarter, slicker, richer than cops in other cities. The rooms were sparsely decorated, almost as if no one lived there. The furniture was mostly leather, but with lots of chrome and marble touches. All angles, no curves. The art on the wall was modern and vaguely depressing. Jackson Pollock and Mark Rothko look-alikes, that sort of thing. It looked like a museum, but one with a lot of mirrors and shiny surfaces. There were several interesting touches, possibly clues, about the gentleman caller. I noted everything, recording, remembering. His dining room hutch held sterling silver, bone china, real stoneware, expensive linen napkins. The gentleman knew how to set his table. On top of his desk were formal writing paper and envelopes with elegant silver trim. Always the gentleman. A copy of Hugh Johnson's Pocket Encyclopedia of Wine was sitting out on the kitchen table. Among his dozen expensive suits were two tuxedos. The suit closet was small, narrow, and oh, so neat. It was less a closet than a shrine for his clothes. Our strange, strange gentleman. I came over to Kate after an hour or so of touring the gentleman's place. I had read the local detective's reports. I'd talked to most of the techs, but so far they had nothing. That didn't seem possible to any of us. The newest laser equipment was being brought from downtown Los Angeles. Rudolph had to have left clues somewhere, but he hadn't. So far, that was his closest parallel to Casanova. "How are you doing?" I asked Kate. "I'm afraid I've been lost in my own world for the last hour." We were at a window overlooking Wilshire Boulevard and also the Los Angeles Country Club, lots of shimmering car and building lights surrounding an 18-hole expanse of darkness. A disturbing Calvin Klein billboard was brightly lit up down on the street. It showed a naked model on a couch. She looked to be about 14. Obsession, the ad proclaimed, for men.
"'I've got my second or third wind,' Kate said. "'All the world's a hideous nightmare suddenly, Alex. "'Have they found anything at all?'
"'I shook my head as I looked at the two of us in the dark, reflective window. "'It's maddening. "'Rudolph commits perfect crimes, too. "'The techies might eventually match fiber from his clothes to one or more of the crime scenes, "'but Rudolph is unbelievably careful. "'I think he has a knowledge of forensic evidence.'
There's enough written about it these days, isn't there? Most doctors are pretty good at absorbing technical information, Alex.
I nodded at the truth of her statement. I thought the same thing. Kate had the makings of a detective. She looked tired. I wondered if I looked as exhausted as I felt.
Don't even say it.
I dialed up a smile.
I'm not going to a hospital now.
I think we're done here for the night, though. We lost him, goddammit. We lost them both. Chapter 74 We left Will Rudolph's penthouse apartment at just past 2 in the morning. That made it 5 a.m. our time. I was reeling, so was Kate. We called ourselves the Bruise Brothers. We were both out of it. Grogginess, exhaustion, possible internal injuries, they were one and the same. If I had ever felt this badly before, I couldn't remember the time and didn't want to. We collapsed into the first of our rooms when we reached the Holiday Inn on Sunset.
"'Are you all right? You don't look so good to me.'
Not unexpectedly, Kate resumed her advertisement for the McTiernan Medical Group. She was a compelling spokeswoman, actually. She had a way of crinkling her forehead that made her look thoughtful and wise and highly professional. "'I'm not dying, I'm just dead tired.' I groaned and slowly lowered myself onto the edge of the comfy bed. "'Just another tough day at the office.'
"'You're so damn stubborn, Alex. "'Always the macho big-city detective. "'All right, I'm going to examine you myself. "'Don't try to stop me or I'll break your arm, "'which I'm entirely capable of doing.'
"'Kate pulled a stethoscope and a sphygmomanometer out of one of her travel bags. "'She wasn't taking no, absolutely not, or no way as an answer. "'I sighed.
"'I'm not having a physical exam now, and especially here,' I told her with as much resolve as I could muster under the circumstances. "'I've seen it all before,'
Kate rolled her eyes and frowned. Then she smiled. No, actually, she laughed. A doctor with a smile and a nice sense of humor. Imagine that.
"'Take your shirt off, Detective Cross,' Kate said to me. "'Make my day. Make my night, anyway.'
I started to pull my shirt over my head. I half moaned, half yelled. Just taking the shirt off hurt like hell. Maybe I was seriously hurt.
"'Oh, you're just fine and dandy,'
Dr. McTiernan pronounced with a wicked chuckle.
"'Can't even get your shirt off.'
She bent in close, extremely close, and listened to my breathing with the stethoscope. I could hear her breathing without the help of any machine. I liked the sound of her heartbeat up close like this. Kate probed my shoulder blade. Then she moved my arm back and forth, and it hurt. Maybe I was banged up a lot worse than I thought. More likely, she wasn't using her gentlest touch while she examined me. She poked my abdomen and ribs next. I saw stars, but not a peep came from me in protest.
"'That hurt at all?'
she asked. Doctor to patient talk. Detached. Professional.
"'No, maybe. Yes, a little. Okay, quite a lot. Ow! That wasn't so bad. Ow!'
"'Getting hit by a train isn't the way to keep the average human body in excellent running shape,' she said.
She touched my ribs again, gentler this time.
"'That wasn't my plan,' I said, offering the only defense I had.
"'What was your plan?'
"'My fleeting thought up at Big Sur was that maybe he knew where Naomi was, and I couldn't let him get away. My ultimate plan was to find Naomi. It still is.'
Kate used both her hands to feel my ribcage. She applied pressure, but nothing too extreme. She asked me if it hurt to take a breath.
"'To tell the truth, I kind of like this part,' I told her. "'You have a nice touch.'
"'Uh-huh. Now the trousers, Alex. You can keep your drawers on if it makes you feel better.'
A little of her drawl was creeping into her speech.
"'My drawers,' I grinned.
"'Your bikini underwear from Gentleman's Quarterly. Whatever you're wearing today, let's see the goodies, Alex.
I'd like to see a little skin. You don't have to show such obvious damn glee about this. I was very much awake all of a sudden. I did like the way Kate touched me, though. I liked it a lot, in fact. Different kinds of sparks were starting to fly. I pulled off my pants. I could not get to my socks, not even close. Not so bad, actually. She offered her opinion of something or other. I began to feel hot, uncomfortably warm in the hotel room. Under these circumstances, anyway. Kate applied gentle pressure against my hips, then against my pelvis. She asked me to slowly raise my feet off the bed, one at a time, while she kept her hands firmly on my hip joints. Very carefully, she felt my legs from my groin area all the way down to my feet. I mostly like that, too. Lots of abrasions, she said. I wish I had some bacitracin ointment on hand. It's an antibiotic. I was just thinking the same thing. Finally, Kate stopped all the probing and poking and pulled away from me. She frowned and wrinkled her nose, nibbled her upper lip. She looked smart, academic, professional as the Surgeon General. Blood pressure's a little high, borderline, but I don't think anything's broken, she pronounced. I don't like the discoloration on your abdomen and your left hip, though. Tomorrow you'll feel sore and stiff, and we have to go over to Cedars Sinai and get a few x-rays taken. Do we have a deal? Actually, I felt a little better after Kate examined me and pronounced that I wouldn't die suddenly during the night. Yes, it wouldn't be a complete day without one of our deals. Thank you for the examination, Doctor. Thank you, Kate, I said. You're quite welcome. It was an honor. She finally smiled. You look a little like Muhammad Ali, you know. The great one. So I have been told. In his prime, I joked. I do dance like a butterfly. I'll bet. I sting like a bee. She winked and crinkled her nose again. A nice tick of hers. Kate lay back on the bed. I stayed there beside her. Close, but not close enough to touch. We were at least a foot apart. Very strange, but nice strange. I missed her touch already. We were quiet for the next minute or so. I glanced over at her. Maybe it was more than a glance. Kate had on a black skirt with black tights, a red peasant blouse. The bruises on her face had faded. I wondered about the rest of her. I held in a sigh. "I'm not Nanu the Ice Queen," she said softly. "Trust me, I'm normal as they come. Frisky, fun, a little crazy. At least I was a month ago." I was surprised that Kate thought I might be feeling that way about her. She was the opposite, warm and compassionate. "I think you're great, Kate, truth be told. I like you an awful lot." There, it was out. Probably an understatement at that. We kissed gently, just the briefest kiss. There was something right about it. I liked the feel of Kate's lips, her mouth on mine. We kissed again, maybe to prove that the first one hadn't been a mistake, or maybe to prove that it had been. I felt as if I could kiss Kate all night, but we both gently pulled away. This was probably more than either of us could handle right now. "Don't you admire my self-control?" Kate smiled and said. "Yes and no," I told her. I pulled on my hair shirt again. It took some effort and produced hellacious pain. I would definitely go for x-rays tomorrow. Kate started to cry and buried her face in the pillow. I turned toward her and put my hand on her shoulder. "You okay?" "Hey."
"I'm sorry." "Shoot," she whispered, trying to stop the tears. I know I don't seem like it most of the time, but I'm freaking out, Alex. I've been freaking out. I've seen so many horrible things. Is this case as bad as your last one? The child kidnapping in D.C.?" she asked me.
I held Kate very gently in my arms. I hadn't seen her quite so vulnerable, so open about it anyway. Everything suddenly became more relaxed between us. I whispered into her hair. This case is as bad as anything I've seen. It's actually worse because of Naomi and because of what happened to you. I want him more than I wanted Gary Sonogy. I want both of these monsters.
When I was a very little girl back home, Kate said, still in a whisper, I was just learning to talk. I was probably 4 months old.
She smiled at the exaggeration.
No, I was around 2. When I would get cold, and I wanted to be held, I'd combine the 2 ideas. I used to say, "Cold me." It meant, "Hold me, I'm cold." Friends can do that. Cold me, Alex.
Friends should, I whispered back. We cuddled on top of the covers and kissed a little more, until we both finally fell asleep. Merciful sleep. I was the one who woke up first. It was 5:11 a.m. on the hotel room clock. "You awake, Kate?" I whispered.
I'm awake now.
We're going back to the gentleman's apartment, I told her. I called ahead and talked to the FBI agent in charge. I told him where to look and what to look for. Chapter 75. Dr. Will Rudolph's once orderly and pristine penthouse apartment had ceased to exist as such. The 3-bedroom penthouse looked like a state-of-the-art crime lab. It was a little past 6 when Kate and I arrived back there. I was pumped about my hunch.
"Did you dream about the gentleman?" Kate wanted to know. "Your hunch?"
"Uh-huh. I was processing information. It's all processed now." A half dozen or so FBI techies and LAPD homicide detectives were still on the scene. The latest Pearl Jam played from somebody's radio. The lead singer seemed to be in terrible pain. Dr. Rudolph's widescreen Mitsubishi TV was on, but the sound was turned off. One of the techies was eating an egg sandwich off greasy paper. I went searching for an agent named Phil Becton, the FBI's suspect profiler. The man. He had been called down from Seattle to gather all the available information on Rudolph, then match it against known data on other psychopaths. A profiler, if he or she is good, is actually invaluable in an investigation of this kind. I'd heard from Kyle Craig that Becton was spooky good. He had been a sociology professor at Stanford before he joined the Bureau. "You fully awake? Ready for this?" Becton asked when I finally located him in the master bedroom. He was at least 6'4", with another 3 inches of wiry red hair. Plastic evidence pouches and manila evidence envelopes were spread all around the bedroom. Becton wore one pair of eyeglasses and had another pair on a chain around his neck. "I'm not sure if I'm awake," I told Becton. "This is Dr. Kate McTiernan." "Nice to meet you." Becton shook hands with her, studying Kate's face at the same time. She was data for him. He seemed a weird man, perfect for his job. "See there?" he said, pointing across the bedroom. The FBI had already taken apart the gentleman's clothes closet. "You were right on the money. We found a fake wall that Dr. Rudolph Hess built behind his skinny clothes closet. There's about 1.5 feet of extra space in there." The clothes closet for his suits had been too skinny and peculiar. I'd made the connection in that strange region of the edge of sleep. The closet had to be his hiding spot. It was a shrine, but not to his expensive suits. "That's where he kept his souvenirs," I made an educated guess.
"You got it. Little waist-high refrigerator freezer back there. It's where he kept the body parts he collected."
Becton pointed to the sealed containers.
"Sonny Azawa's feet, fingers, 2 ears with different earrings, 2 separate victims."
"What else was in his collection?" I asked Phil Becton. I wasn't in a hurry to look at feet, ears, fingers, his trophies from the murders of young girls around L.A.
"Well, as you'd expect from reading the murder scene briefs, he likes to collect their underwear as well. Freshly worn panties, bras, pantyhose, a woman's T-shirt that says Dazed and Confused, and still smells of opium perfume. He likes to keep photographs, a few locks of auburn hair. He's so neat. He kept each specimen in its own plastic bag. 1 through 31. He's labeled them with numbers.
Preserve the smells, I muttered. The sandwich bags. Becton nodded, and he also grinned like a gawky, goofy teenager.
Kate looked at the two of us as if we were both a little nuts, which we were. There's something else I think you should see, though. This you're going to appreciate. Come over to my office.
On a plain wooden table next to the bed were some of the gentleman's treasures and souvenirs. Most of the paraphernalia had already been marked. It takes an organized task force to catch an organized killer. Spooky good Phil Becton emptied out one of the 5x7-inch envelopes so I could see the contents. A single photograph fell out of the envelope. It was of a young male, probably in his early 20s. The condition of the photo, as well as the male's clothing, suggested it had been taken years earlier. 8 to 10 years was my quick guess. The hair on my neck was starting to rise. I cleared my throat. Who's this supposed to be?
Do you know this man, Dr. McTiernan?
Phil Becton turned to Kate.
Ever see this man before?
I don't know.
Kate answered Phil Becton. She swallowed hard. The gentleman's bedroom was quiet. Outside on the streets of Los Angeles, the orangish-red glow of morning had fallen over the city. Becton handed me metal tweezers that he kept handy in his breast pocket.
Flip it over for all the vital stats. Just like those Topps baseball cards we used to collect as kids. At least we did in Portland.
I figured that Becton had collected a lot more than baseball cards in his life and times. I carefully turned over the photo. A neatly handwritten legend was on the back. It reminded me of the way Nana Mama identified every single old photo in our house.
"Sometimes you forget who people are, Alex, even people in photographs with you," she told me. "You don't believe me, but you'll see as time passes you by."
I didn't think that Will Rudolph was likely to forget the person in the picture, but he had handwritten a legend all the same. My head was spinning a little. We finally had an unbelievable break in the case. I was holding it right under my nose with crime scene tweezers. "Dr. Wick Sachs," the handwriting on the photo read. A doctor, I thought. Another doctor. Imagine that. "Durham, North Carolina," the legend continued. "He was from the Research Triangle area. He was from the South." "Casanova," Rudolph had written. Part 4. Twinning. Chapter 76. Naomi Cross was awakened by rock music blaring from the wall speakers. She recognized the Black Crows. The overhead lights flashed on and off. She jumped out of bed and quickly pulled on wrinkled jeans and a turtleneck and ran to the door of her room. The loud music and boldly flashing lights signaled a meeting. Something terrible has happened, she thought. Her heart was in free fall. Casanova kicked open the door. He had on tight jeans, engineering boots, a black leather jacket. His mask was painted with chalky streaks that resembled lightning. He was in a frenzy. Naomi had never seen him look this angry.
"Living room, now!"
he shouted as he grabbed her arm and yanked her out of the room. The floor of the narrow corridor felt damp and cold under Naomi's bare feet. She had forgotten to put on her sandals. It was too late to go back for them. She fell in step with a young woman. The two of them walked nearly parallel to each other. Naomi was surprised when the woman quickly turned her head and stared at her. The eyes were large and deep green. Naomi had given her the name Green Eyes.
"I'm Kristen Miles," the woman spoke in a hurried whisper. "We have to do something to help ourselves. We have to take a chance, and soon."
Naomi said nothing in response, but she reached out and lightly grazed the back of Green Eyes' hand. Contact was forbidden, but just to touch another human inside the horrifying prison was necessary now. Naomi looked into the woman's eyes and saw only defiance, no fear. That made her feel so good. Both of them had kept themselves together somehow. The captive women in the hallway glanced furtively at Naomi as they shuffled in silence toward the living room in the strange house. Their eyes were dark and hollow. Some of them didn't wear makeup anymore, and their appearance frightened Naomi. It was getting worse every day, ever since Kate McTiernan had managed to escape somehow. Casanova had brought a new girl to the house, Anna Miller. Anna was breaking the house rules just as Kate McTiernan had done. Naomi had heard the woman's cries for help, and Casanova might have heard them, too. It was difficult to figure out when he would be away. He kept very odd hours. Lately, Casanova was leaving them without any contact for longer and longer periods. He wasn't going to let them go. That was one of his lies. Naomi knew it was getting dangerous for all the women. Naomi sensed something desperate in the air. She could hear cries of alarm up ahead, and she tried to calm her own mounting fears and panic. She had lived in the projects of Washington. She'd seen horror before. Two of her friends had been murdered by the time she was 16. Then she heard him. His voice was strange and high-pitched. He was a madman.
"Come right in, ladies. Don't be shy. Don't stop in the doorway. Come in, come in. Join the party, the swinging soiree."
Casanova was yelling above the testosterone rock and roll that blared through the halls. Naomi closed her eyes for a brief moment. She tried to collect herself. "I don't want to see this, whatever it is, but I have to." She finally entered the room. Her body began to shake. What she saw was worse than anything she remembered from the projects. She had to push her fist into her mouth to keep from screaming out. A long, slender body twirled in lazy circles from the ceiling beams. The woman was naked, except for silver-blue stockings running up her long legs. A blue high-heeled shoe dangled from one foot. The other shoe had dropped to the floor and lay on its side. The girl's lips were already purplish-blue, and her tongue protruded sideways from them. The eyes were stretched wide with terror and pain. It must be Anna, Naomi thought. A girl had been calling out for help. She'd broken the house rules. She said her name was Anna Miller. Poor Anna. Whoever you were before he kidnapped you. Casanova turned off the music and spoke calmly from behind his mask. He talked as if nothing much had happened.
"Her name is Anna Miller, and she did this to herself. Do you all understand what I'm saying? She was plodding through the walls, talking about escaping. There is no escape from here."
Naomi shuddered. No, there is no escape from hell, she thought. She looked at Green Eyes and nodded her head. Yes, they had to take a chance, and soon. Chapter 77. The gentlemen stopped to play the game in Stoneman Lake, Arizona. It was a beautiful morning for it. It was crisp and cool, and the smell of a wood fire was in the air. He was parked in the woods among the boulders, just off the rural road. No one could see him. He sat there and thought about the way this should go down as he watched a cozy, white-shingled family house through hooded lids. He could actually feel the beast taking over, the transformation, the strange passion that accompanied it, Jekyll and Hyde. He saw a man leave the house and get into a silver Ford Aerostar. The husband seemed in a hurry, probably late for work. His wife was alone now, maybe still in bed. Her name was Juliet Montgomery. At a little past 8, he carried an empty gas container up to the house. If anybody happened to see him, no problem. He needed fuel for his rented car. No one saw him. Probably nobody around for miles. The gentleman climbed the front porch steps. He paused for a moment, then gently turned the doorknob. He found it amazing that people didn't lock their doors in Stoneman Lake. God, he loved this, lived for it. His times as Mr. Hyde. Juliet was making breakfast for herself. He could hear her half-humming, half-singing as he made his way across the living room. The aroma and the crackling sound of bacon frying made him think of his family's house in Asheville. His father had been the original gentleman, army colonel, and proud and arrogant about it. Inflexible asshole who was never pleased about anything his son did. Big fan of the thick leather belt to instill discipline. Liked to scream at the top of his lungs as he beat the shit out of him. Raised the perfect son. High school standout scholar and athlete. Phi Beta Kappa undergrad. High honors in Duke Medical School. Human monster.
He watched Juliet Montgomery from the doorway that led into her spotlessly clean kitchen. The window shades were up, and the room was flooded with sunlight. She was still singing an old Jimi Hendrix song called Castles Made of Sand. Unexpected tune from the pretty lady. He loved watching her like this, when she thought she was alone. Singing something she'd probably be embarrassed to in front of him, carefully laying out her three strips of bacon on a paper towel that came close to matching the beige and brown kitchen wallpaper. Juliet wore a sheer white cottony negligee that fluttered around her thighs as she moved between the stove and table. She was in her mid-twenties, long dancer's legs, nicely tanned, bare feet on the kitchen linoleum. Auburn hair she'd bothered to brush before coming down to make breakfast. A set of knives in a butcher block holder sat on the counter. He took out the cleaver. The knife made a soft ringing noise as it lightly struck a stainless steel pot on the counter. She turned at the sound. Very lovely in profile, freshly scrubbed, radiant. Juliet liked herself, too. He could tell that she did.
"Who are you? What are you doing in my house?"
The words came out in small gasps. Her face was as pale as her negligee. "Now move fast," he told himself. He grabbed Juliet and held the cleaver up high. Shades of Hitchcock's Psycho and also Frenzy. High-concept melodrama. "Don't make me hurt you. It's all in your control," he said softly. She stopped the scream before it got out of her mouth, but the scream was in her eyes. He loved the look on Juliet's face, lived for it. "I won't hurt you as long as you don't do anything to hurt me. Are we all right so far? Are we clear as a bell?" She nodded her head curtly, a couple of nods. Her blue-green eyes were tilted up strangely. She was afraid to move her head too much for fear he'd slash her. She sighed. Amazing. She seemed to trust him a little. His voice had that effect on people. His style and fine manners. Mr. Hyde, the gentleman caller. She was looking deeply into his eyes, searching for some explanation. He had seen that questioning look so many times before. "Why?" it said. "I'm going to take your panties off now. No doubt this has been done for you before, so there's no reason to panic. You have the softest, nicest skin." "I mean that," said the gentleman. The cleaver slashed quickly. "I like you, Juliet. I really do. As much as I'm able to like anyone," the gentleman said in his softest voice. Chapter 78 Kate McTiernan was home again. Home again, home again, jiggity jig. First thing she did was to call her sister Carol Ann, who lived far away in Maine now. Then she called a few close friends in Chapel Hill. She reassured them that she was perfectly all right. That was total bullshit, of course. She knew that she wasn't anything close to all right, but why cause them to worry? It wasn't Kate's way to inconvenience other people with her unsolvable problems. Alex didn't want her to go back to her house, but she had to. This was where she lived. She tried to calm herself a little, to slow down the big bad world in her head, at least. She drank wine and watched late-night TV. She hadn't done that in years. Centuries. She was missing Alex Cross already, and more than she wanted to admit to herself. Staying home and watching TV was a good test, but she was failing miserably. She was such a schlump sometimes. She had developed, what, a schoolgirl crush on Alex? He was strong, smart, funny, kind. He loved children, and was even in touch with the child in himself. He had a sculpted body, fabulous bone structure, a sensational torso also. Yes, she had a crush on Alex Cross. Understandable. Nice. Only maybe it was more than a crush. Kate wanted to call Alex at his hotel in Durham. She picked up the phone a couple of times. No. She wouldn't let herself do it. Nothing was going to happen between her and Alex Cross. She was an intern, and she wasn't getting any younger.
He lived in Washington with his two children and his grandmother. Besides, they were too much alike, and it wouldn't work out. He was a willful black man. She was an extremely willful white woman. He was a homicide detective. But he was also sensitive and sexy and generous. She didn't care whether he was black, green, or purple. He made her laugh. He made her as happy as a clam in deep, wet sand. But nothing was going to happen between her and Alex. She would just sit here in her scary apartment, drink her cheap Pinot Noir, watch her bad, semi-romantic Hollywood movie, be afraid, be a little horny, let it get worse. That's what she would do, damn it. Build her character. She had to admit she was frightened to be in her own house, though. She hated that feeling. She wanted all of this shitty madness to stop, but it wouldn't. Not even close. There were still two horrifying monsters on the loose out there. She kept hearing creepy noises all around her in the house. Old creaking wood, banging shutters. Wind chimes she had put on an old elm tree outside. The chimes reminded her of the cabin in Big Sur. They had to come down tomorrow, if not sooner. Kate finally fell asleep with the wine glass, which was really an old Flintstones jelly glass, balanced in her lap. The glass was a holy relic from the house in West Virginia. She and her sisters used to fight over it sometimes at breakfast. The glass tipped and spilled onto her bed covers. It didn't matter. Kate was dead to the world, for one night at least. She didn't usually drink much. The Pinot Noir hit her like the freight trains that used to rumble through Birch when she was a kid. She woke at 3 a.m. with a throbbing headache and hurried into her bathroom where she got sick. Images of Psycho flashed through her mind as she bent over the sink. She thought of Casanova in the house again. He was in the bathroom, wasn't he? No. Of course no one was there. Please make this stop. Make this end. Right now. She went back to bed and crawled under the covers. She heard the wind rattling the shutters. Heard those stupid chimes. She thought about death, her mother, Suzanne, Marjorie, Kristen. All gone now. Kate McTiernan pulled the blanket over her head. She felt like a little girl again, afraid of the bogeyman. Okay, she could handle that. Trouble was, she could see Casanova and the horrifying death mask whenever she closed her eyes. She held a secret thought buried in the center of her chest. He was coming for her again, wasn't he? At 7 in the morning, her phone rang. It was Alex. "Kate, I was in his house," he said. Chapter 79. Around 10, the night we returned from California, I drove to the Hope Valley residential area of Durham. I went alone to see Casanova. Dr. Detective Cross was back in the saddle again. There were three clues that I considered essential to solving the case. I reviewed them again as I drove. There was the simple fact that they both committed perfect crimes. There was the aspect of twinning, the codependence of Casanova and the gentleman. There was the mystery of the disappearing house. Something had to come from one or all of those bits of information. Maybe something was about to happen in the Hope Valley suburb of Durham. I hoped so. I drove slowly along Old Chapel Hill Road until I reached a formal white brick portal-type entrance into the upscale Hope Valley Estates. I got the feeling that I wasn't supposed to intrude beyond the gate, that just maybe I was the first black man, not in working man's overalls, to pass through here. I knew I was taking a chance, but I had to see where Dr. Wick Sachs lived. I needed to feel things about him, needed to know him better and in a big hurry. The streets of Hope Valley didn't run in straight lines. The road I was on didn't have curbs or gutters, and there were not many street lamps. The neighborhood was unpleasantly hilly, and as I drove, I began to have the sense of being lost, of moving in a great, looping circle. The houses were mostly upscale Southern Gothic, old and expensive. The notion of the killer next door had never been more powerful. Dr. Wick Sachs lived in a stately red brick house set back on one of the highest hills, The shutters were painted white, matching the gutters. The house looked too expensive for a university professor, even one at Duke, the Harvard of the South. The windows were all dark and looked as shiny as slate.